Hello, this is Mark Brown at the second day of the Department of Psychiatry of Oxford University's 50th anniversary celebration. I'm here with...
Sina Fazel.
And Danny Whiting.
Both these gentlemen gave a fantastic and really interesting presentation about prediction models in psychiatry. Now, for everyone listening at home, the question is going to be, what the hell is a prediction model? And what I'm hoping for us to begin with is that at least one of you can explain basically what a prediction model is and how they work.
So it's a way of, I think broadly speaking, it's a way of thinking about prognosis. So how well you're going to do, or how unfortunately badly you might do. So you can think of almost like using a weather app. I mean, a weather app gives you a percentage score of what's the chance of it raining over, you know, 24-hour period or even beyond that. And prediction models are a similar type of way of thinking about things. They look forward and they say, well, what's the chance of something happening? What's the likelihood of something happening? And they usually work, the best known ones like this, the risk scores for heart disease, they usually work by giving you a probability score. So they sort of say over a 10-year period, what's your chance of having a cardiovascular event like a heart attack or a stroke? And on the basis of that, you can start to think about treatments. They might be, in the case of heart problems, it might be dietary changes, lifestyle changes, more exercise, and then even start a discussion with your doctor about a medication like a statin. So that's how it's been developed in cardiovascular medicine. And I think what we were looking at yesterday was whether this has a role in psychiatry. And I think the three areas that it probably does have a role is diagnosis. So can it help people make diagnoses, particularly an area where dementia researchers are very focused on, because there, if you make a diagnosis early, you can really potentially arrest the development of it. And the area that we looked at was prognosis. So looking forward, and particularly things like violence risk, suicide risk, is really important outcomes in psychiatry. Can you predict, or can you give some sort of prognostic model that helps people prevent these outcomes? And the third area, which is what actually the talk after us spoke about, was something about choice of treatment. So can you actually predict who will benefit from this particular SSRI in the talk we heard about versus another SSRI? And that could apply to other treatments as well. So broadly speaking, it's about trying to use high quality data to think about, you know, what individuals will benefit from, you can figure out how to plan future interventions, future treatments, based on all sorts of factors that you can put into a model.
So kind of one of the really interesting things when you were talking about prediction models yesterday was kind of the value of prediction models in predicting things that might be rarer or less likely to be experienced. And those tend to be kind of quite contentious issues.
Yeah, so I think one of the points to make is that certainly in clinical psychiatry, we're already having to try and predict these rarer outcomes to plan our decisions and plan our treatment. So we're already doing that. So what a prediction model can bring to that is a way to try and anchor that difficult process in the evidence base as best we can, and use epidemiological data to try and help us make those decisions. And it is to sort of help that rather than to replace the whole process of clinical assessment. And I think when we think about the difficulties of predicting rare outcomes, how we kind of frame the point of a prediction model is really important. So what we're more interested in is how a prediction model can identify those patients who sort of on average are the most likely to benefit from something helpful and non-harmful, to try and reduce the risk of that rare outcome, and the balance on how accurate the tool needs to be depends very much on what it is that you're going to link it to, and if it's something that's going to be helpful and non-harmful, then we can sort of tolerate a false positive rate in a different way.
So one of the things you were talking about was kind of prediction of violence from people experiencing psychosis. And this is like a really, really In mental health circles, this is kind of very, very awkward area to talk about. And it feels like there's a general kind of awkwardness around discussing these things in a kind of general forum. So with that in mind, how should we think about this that might make it feel a bit less awkward?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's one of the challenges of working this way with both clinically and in research. I mean, one of the things that can be gained from looking at a more objective way to help think about violence risk is trying to unpick some of these questions. So trying to do some work on how patients prefer us to talk about violence risk, and actually we're assessing violence risk all the time anyway, and at the moment I think that's sometimes quite a mysterious process, not very transparent. It might not be something that's shared that openly with patients, so one thing that a tool might be able to do is make that a bit more open actually, and actually ground it in the evidence and give us a bit more of a kind of framework for how to talk about that with patients, and so I think it might be a beneficial thing.
There's also one of the main points people raise in response to prediction models in anything is the issue of implicit bias, which assumes that prediction models either aren't transparent or can't be transparent. Basically, they'll be made by someone and it'll predict what they want to see. Is that a fair suspicion to level at what you spend most of your time doing?
I think it's a very important area in the field to try and clarify. I mean, I think the thing that we're doing differently is we're very transparent about how we choose our predictors, we pre-specify everything, we publish a protocol, and then when we publish the model, we publish all the model coefficients, so you can actually see exactly how a score is made up, what contributes to it, and that's very different to many models, like you're saying, where it's sort of hidden away somewhere, you don't really know what contributes to it. And I think that's really important. So I mean, and that's really come out of working partly with people in other areas of medicine who we've collaborated with quite closely in Oxford, and also with ethicists also, who have helped us think through these issues. That really the importance of pre-specifying what you're doing, being very very thoughtful and open about how you're choosing your predictors, that they're predictors that are usable, are fair in a way, transparent, and I think a big part of our model is also making them scalable, so they're easy to use. Actually, all the models we've developed are free, and they're you can see how they've been developed, you can see all the model coefficients, and we publish as much as we can of validations of the work.
So do you think kind of doing this work kind of in the public sector, in paid for with public money, is a good way of avoiding like the black boxing of algorithms, because commercially produced algorithms, you're selling the result of them, so you basically, the imperative is to hide how you get to your conclusion. Do you think kind of public funding kind of ensures a kind of transparency and a kind of accountability in algorithmic manipulations of reality and future events?
Well, partly, but of course, even if publicly funded things are not published openly, I mean, so people can hide, the how the models are developed and, how they're derived, and then they often don't bother to validate them. They sort of stop at publishing the model and they just leave it there. They publish the derivation or discovery sample and they just leave it there. They don't actually look at how it works in practice. So I think it's something that applies across the board, actually. And I think, but I think there are some funding agencies like the Wellcome, who fund me, that are very clear that these, about the importance of open access and data being available, and I think that's very helpful actually, and particularly where the implications can be quite serious. So for instance, I mean, one of the models we've developed is for released prisoners, and of course you want these models to be as accurate as possible, and people can see the level of accuracy, and then they can make decisions based on that, and you really want that very very clear, because of the potential implications. I mean, people might be
are followed up more frequently. There might be all these resources put into linking people to community services, and you want that level of input to be based on something firm and evidence-based.
So to kind of finish up between you both, I'm going to ask you a really, really difficult question, which is to suggest a few things that people at home might think about if they're very, very worried about being on the receiving end of this kind of predictive technology. Like, how should people think about this, and what should they be looking out for and thinking about?
That's a good question.
It's a horrible question.
It's obviously increasingly in the sort of public awareness of this kind of work ongoing at the moment, especially with the sort of huge scaling up of sort of NHS digital data and the sort of access to that. It's a sort of hot topic, if you like. I think what's really clear from sort of gauging kind of public opinion on this kind of work is that there has to be a really for there to be support, there has to be a really clear kind of public benefit to it, and I think that is what drives all type of work that we're talking about is ultimately about improving kind of treatment pathways and making the whole experience of contact with, in our case, mental health services more helpful and for better outcomes. There's sort of healthy questioning of the mechanics of it, but I think the work we're talking about, that's what is driving it.
So someone yesterday was talking very much about you have to ask and answer the question, so what? Like, so what, why does any of this matter? And also, how do I know I'm not evil? But to give you the final words on that.
Well, I think in relation to all this, I think it really can augment clinical care. I mean, so yeah, these tools, if they're well developed, empirically based, and validated in the real world, they can really augment decision making, and they can facilitate discussions between clinicians and their patients, and so they can actually, I think, really lead to improvements. And you know, we saw, I mean, a couple of weeks ago there was a very interesting piece coming out about the Mental Health Act and how there does seem to be a racial bias in it, you know. And well, one of the things that occurred to me when I read that was, you know, actually these tools are one way of just looking at whether your decisions about risk, which are about mental health, is all about suicide and violence risk, you know, are they based in something empirical, or are you actually working on all sorts of subconscious biases? And these can act as a way of, I don't know, sort of anchoring your judgments, raising the ceiling of expertise, reminding you of the importance of certain risk factors, weighing up a sort of range of factors, which the human brain really can't cope with more than 3 or 4, but you know, these tools usually have about 10, 15 factors in them. So it's putting that all together, and I do think there's a potential for it really to improve the clinical care, plus also the relationship between doctors and their patients.
Brilliant. So what I'm hearing from you, just to finish this up, is it might be possible to make predictive models that don't have biases, but human beings always do. I think that's a point to finish on. Thank you both.